I wasn't into computers until I actually did that, because it was like I was probably 18 years old. Like in my childhood, I only played outside in the mountains, in the rivers. Like I used to run with a machete in my hand, just like,
whoa, you know,
just cutting grass. Man, I'm from South America. That's how we do it. So it is like that. And I say this because I'm actually happy that I had this childhood where I could just like interact with nature and eventually just find this thing that is going to be the tool and the stuff that I want to.
Hello and welcome to Committing to Cloud Native, the podcast where we talk about the confluence of cloud native and open source. Super excited about our guest today, which is kind of what I say for most guests, but this one in particular, just because he is awesome energy and helped us deal with some squabbles in the beginning with technology, which makes me think that open source and cloud native will also be dealt with appropriately. Very excited about that. Before I introduce Flavio, oh no, I already did. I want to introduce the other panelists here. We have Justin Dorfman. Justin, how are you?
I'm doing great. How are you, Richard?
I'm good. Thanks for asking. And Suri Bar-Yochai. Suri, how are you doing?
It's Bar-Yochai, not Bar-Yochai, Richard. Time for you to get it right.
And anyway, Suri Bar-Yochai.
There you go. There you go. Episode number 8 or number 10, who knows? And you got it correctly. And I'm fine, by the way. Great day today.
Glad to hear it. All right. Flavio Percoco. Did I get that right? Did I get it right?
You did. Yeah.
Okay.
I got it right at first, though. It's way better than Zuri's one.
Well, it's so good to have you. Flavio is joining us today from his beautiful mansion in Lake Como, because I can't imagine anyone living in Lake Como and not having a giant, awesome house on the lake. He's a software engineer at Red Hat. Flavio, how often do you just sit and look at your lake mansion and think, this is it, I've made it?
I mean, quite often, but I'll have to invite you over to show you what a mansion actually means in Italy. It's like very packed, tiny place where everyone lives. It's not what you're thinking of right now. The only people that have mansions here is like George Clooney and those people. But like, I guess it's fine. The lake is awesome. So I go there quite often, actually, when I'm in town. It's great to sit there, eat an ice cream.
We can do
but
like-
you're not always in town, because you often do a lot of conferences and you're a speaker and you travel the world all the time. Right. Correct. Now you're working on OpenStack, right? Can you talk a bit about that?
Well, I used to work on OpenStack. I worked on OpenStack for like 6 years. I don't know. Oh. I was like from 2013 to... Someone was asking me this the other day, like, when did you start? Like, what was the name of the release that you started? And I was like, man, I don't know. I was like Grizzly, Folsom, one of those. And then worked there for like 6 years, more or less. And then I moved on to working on OpenStack and Kubernetes at the same time, because OpenStack was not busy enough, I guess. And so I started working on integrating those two and eventually just moved on from there for a couple of years to break from that. And then now I'm back. I moved to Elastic and I started working on something completely different. I started working. It was always related to infrastructure, but I did not have to build the software that was providing that infrastructure. I was just able to use it and build stuff on top of that infrastructure and kind of like put my hands back into DevOps, which is something that I hadn't done in like several years ever since I started working at Red Hat. And then spent a couple of years at Elastic and back at Red Hat, full time there, working on OpenShift. Yeah, working on OpenShift mostly. I'm mostly focused on OpenShift deployment workflows on bare metal nodes. So everything that has to do with dealing with your data center, your bare metal nodes, and how to make that easier for customers and all the telcos and edge cases and that kind of thing. So it's an exciting field. You work with like fewer resources and you gotta get creative on how to build your regions and data centers and how to automate that in a way that you can deploy thousands and thousands of those bare metal nodes without actually bringing everything down, I guess. And also the hardest part, I think, of this whole process is not so much how to automate the whole process, but is, and I've always said, is like day zero operations. They're like, to some extent, they're easy. They're like a solved problem. And this is a problem that we're trying to like make easy for everyone. The real hard problem comes from day two operations, where you actually have to manage the whole cluster and all your regions and all your zones and all that kind of things. So that's when the actual real infrastructure management really starts. So if you don't provide the right tools and a way for people to actually manage their infrastructure easily, then it's hard to really scale it at the levels that we want people to scale this thing.
So how does OpenShift provide that? You said like it helps you deploy your bare metal nodes. I'm pretty sure I know what that means, but why OpenShift versus any other
deployment? Well, so this is something that at Red Hat, we believe is a very important problem to solve. So the only reason I say OpenShift is because mostly that's Red Hat's product, really. So that's what we go and sell to customers and people that are using it. It's still open source, so we really still support, but it's all based on Kubernetes, really. So the specific tool that I'm working on is still open source. People can use it. It relies a lot on some of the OpenShift internals, but all the other pieces around this tool that we call assisted installer, assisted service, all the related pieces around it, they're all open source, they're all part of the upstream community. They all have an upstream community, part of the CNCF. So they all follow the Kubernetes release cycle and try to be as community friendly and as open source friendly as possible, which is Red Hat's full passion, upstream first.
Nice. So assisted installer is what you're mainly working on at the moment. It sounds like you've touched like everything, which is awesome.
Yeah, the assisted service would be assisted installer is, so assisted service is a piece of the assisted installer. It's mainly the thing that I'm working on Red Hat. Spending most of my hours there and trying to get the whole story straight. Because assisted installer can do not only bare metal, it can also do deployed OpenShift on cloud providers and do other stuff. So the part that I'm mostly interested in, honestly, is all the bare metal on-prem kind of like use case of this installer.
Nice. So you mentioned CNCF there. Which one of these is a CNCF project?
Well, Kubernetes is. I'm just kidding. So that is a big part of it. So there's another community which uses, it's not so much which of the projects is 100% part of the CNCF, but rather what parts of these projects that are already part of the CNCF. So for instance, like you see Kubernetes is part of the CNCF, but then there are a bunch of internal APIs, like the cluster API, the machine API, and some other internal interfaces that allow people to build all these tools and services that interact with the Kubernetes cluster and that allow them to manage other resources like bare metal nodes and like VMs and networking and some other parts of the whole infrastructure environment. So I would say the main project that is part of the CNCF that I'll touch and work on is really Kubernetes and everything that is around it that will allow us to actually provide this install experience that we want people to have when deploying OpenShift.
So I have this like existential question, which is you're talking about all these projects, you've been working in this industry for years and you're providing services for people who are setting up their infrastructures, but that's not what you're doing. You're building the tools for them to do that work. So how do you stay relevant? How do you know what the clients need? How do you choose what projects you're interested in, seeing as how you're not a person throwing up all these instances every single day?
Yeah, that is a, it's fun that you're asking that. That is an interesting question. It's a question that I really posed myself the first time when I joined Red Hat the first time back in 2013, where I started working on OpenStack and we were building this, the OpenStack story really for Red Hat. When I joined, there were like, we were really few people compared to how big the team is right now. And one of the things that we kind of like stress a lot in the OpenStack community when we started building new services and growing the community itself is how do we get data from the field? Let's put like Red Hat for like aside in a second, for a second. Like let's talk about the OpenStack community as a community. Assuming we don't have any company behind us, how do we get people to actually tell us how they're using software so that we can make it better? Something that is, I don't want to generalize, but I believe like many developers miss the fact that if you develop things in a box, if you develop things in your tiny like world without looking at how people are actually running your software, you're really just developing a software that works for you. It's one of those stories that it works on my laptop, but like there's so many gotchas when you actually run your software and then you put it in production and you actually have people using your stuff that you don't realize them until you're actually running it. And many times people don't run your software the way you think they're doing it. And many times they're not even using it for the stuff that you created it for. So how do we get all these people to actually give us that information? So what we started doing in the OpenStack community was creating this subset of the community, so to speak, that was the operators community. So how do we welcome these operators so that they feel that they can be part of the community? They are community, like 100% community OpenStack contributors, even if they don't commit any code to the OpenStack code base. So we push for this, establish this, and try to like making them part of the technical committee and try to make them like a central piece of the entire community. And something very similar is what, you know, I try to do from within Red Hat. So there's these things that you can do in an open source community where you try to like bring more contributors to it, bring people that are actually using the software and being part of the decision-making process. Because at the end of the day, they are the ones that are actually scaling your software. They bring like some use cases that you're like, I had no idea that you can actually do that with the software that I was writing. So something similar is for a company like Red Hat, but like Red Hat is a big company. So, and it has like many people taking care of all these like product management and all those things. So as an engineer at Red Hat, I take good care of basically chasing down product managers so that they tell me what customers want. When I joined, like when we were building this OpenStack team at Red Hat, I remember just going to the product managers of this software that I was working on and telling them, I want you to bring me all the customers' experience. I want to know how they're running the software, all the problems that they're running into. And there was a lot of that and also a lot of interacting with our support team. Because the Red Hat support team is awesome. Like they take care of so many issues without it. Like we're level two, like engineering is like 2 or 3, I don't know. Like you put a number on it, but like many times we don't even know all the issues that they're working on because they can solve them. But many times knowing what issues they are solving for the customers will bring more information on what we can actually improve in this. So there's a lot of like chasing that, at least for me at the very beginning, it was a lot of chasing down product managers and making sure that I could interact more with the support. So I would collect all this information and either just like build my own proposals or like bring it up back upstream so that people would know how some of their customers were using the software and what other things could be improved. And many of these conversations just end up being in requests for changes upstream, like requests for improvements and new proposals of new features or things that are bugs that need to be changed. It's still true. It's still like that. At the end of the day, it's good to have good processes so that engineers know, what things to work on and what things are important. But it's also, I truly believe that it's also the engineer's responsibility or the developer's responsibility to go and try to find this information, because at the end of the day, like you're building a software that someone else has to use and for various use cases. Some of them are mission critical. Some of them are just someone running OpenShift on their desktop. It's fine, but they're all important. They are all people like that are interested in running the software. So knowing these use cases, you're not going to be able to solve them all, but at least knowing that they exist is definitely going to make you a better developer, I believe.
Got it. So like on GitHub, you're part of two really big organizations, Kubernetes and the Kubernetes Special Interest Group. You could work pretty much anywhere with those in mind. What made you want to go back to Red Hat? What is it exactly that made you say, Red Hat's the place to be, and I've been there once, and I'm going to go back and do the experience again?
To me, it was a lot of people, culture, and the fact that Red Hat is an open source company. So to me, culture is something that is extremely important. People say, like, if you want to really be contributing to open source software, you have to be thick skin and like you got to be like this, like super rough human being. I'm not. I have no time to be fighting with people. I have zero patience for people that are not willing to contribute and cooperate and stuff like that. I want to work on things that excite everyone and that have an impact on the general world. So if you look at the software that we normally work on when we're at Red Hat, is a software that many times, honestly, like people don't even realize that they're using. Like many people don't even know that they depend on this software. But then like, I know it. And it's a software that makes me happy to work on. And the people that I work with, they're great human beings. The culture of the company puts people first over many other things, many costs. So that is something that for me is like super valuable, especially in these times and especially in this period of like even the tech industry where it's easy to burn out, it's easy to be fed up with many things. So I would summarize it in people, culture, and definitely the challenges that we're working on.
Well, Flavio, you mentioned that the software you're working on makes you happy. Well, I can tell from the little time I know you that you do what you like and you like what you do, which is a good thing. But everybody I know from our profession, right? People in our industry, most of them at least, they have two moments in their life. The first moment is the moment they knew they want to go into computers, software, and so on. And then the second one is the moment when they look back and say, well, I think I made the right choice. This is indeed my profession. This is indeed my trade. Would you mind sharing with us those moments?
Sure. Well, the first moment is probably easier for me. I've tried many things. So I have many ideas. I've always had many things that I want to do. It's probably one of my, I wouldn't say my strength is actually the opposite. It's one of the things that I tend to spread myself to think on many things. Call it curiosity, call it whatever you want. So when I finished high school, I guess I was looking into many things. I even signed up for psychology and medicine and a bunch of other things. But then eventually I ended up doing, because of the same curiosity, I ended up doing taking a LAMP course. Honestly, I was all PHP, MySQL all the way down and some HTML in there. And that just clicked with me. And I started playing with it a little bit, like doing all the challenges and all the logic. But it was not that. It was not like love at first sight. The thing that really made me fall in love with this is what I did after. So I did my internship, working on web development and stuff like that. And then eventually I moved into this other company that was building a Linux distribution for mostly focused on assistive technology. So it was built for blind people or people with vision problems and people with motion problems to actually be able to use a computer. And I was working on that distribution and I was working on the software back in the day. It was called Orca. And I created this other software that was called Mousetrap, which would allow you to move the cursor just with your webcam and your face. And that was the thing that really just made me fall in love with computers, is the fact that you're bringing this access to technology. You have the power to bring technology to many people in different places and improve people's lives and have a huge impact in what society looks like today and what the world is going to look like tomorrow. So that is the thing that really made me completely fall in love with it. I ended up working on that for a while and then eventually ended up moving to a different country. So I just switched jobs for obvious reasons, I guess. And then eventually I started doing something else. But it's always been, to me, it's always been important to be working on something that I believe will have a significant impact in the way we use technology today and the way the world works.
So you talked about going around to product managers and making sure that they get feedback to you, because it's your job as an engineer to listen to your users and to make sure that you're able to build tools that they could actually use. And you talked about how you want to improve people's lives and improve their access to tech. You must have a very unique position, being someone who has that mindset and has worked the places you've worked, to know how cloud native infrastructure can actually help people's lives in the future. And so I'm wondering where you think it's going and how you think we can get there.
Where I think it's going, I would say it's going in the right direction. That would be my first answer. And I think we're making many things right. And it's interesting. So some of the cases, like when we talk about telcos, they're very interesting use cases because you end up enabling the infrastructure that eventually enables communication all across the world. Right, you're providing the software that these massive companies are actually using. If you think about it, I'm not going to say any names because, okay, but eventually when you're using this carrier and you're calling, they're making calls and you're just imagine in your head, it's like right now in this antenna, this is happening because the software that I built that I worked on is actually handling all this traffic. And when people can call, I don't know, emergency number, 911s, or even other more less dramatic use cases where you're just calling your loved ones and you're enabling communication for people. Those are very important. But these days it's very hyped, telco, edge, that kind of things. But if you also look at, automotive, which is something that Red Hat is starting to get into, it's pretty awesome to know that you're also enabling and improving the way all the automotive world is actually working and the way it is evolving. They're also more, I don't want to say simpler because I don't want this to sound that they're not as important or as impressive, but even just enabling research for universities, for colleges, it's extremely important for people to have the right infrastructure to be able to develop whatever they are doing research on and be able to do it also without having to do a massive upfront investment, which is something that tends to be a massive impediment for people to actually move on and the stuff that they're interested in. So making this software that people are free to use at any point and that they can learn from. And this is the other thing that to me, not only in the cloud native world, but all the open source world is extremely important, because I didn't go to college. Everything I learned it by reading someone else's code. I learned it by working on open source. I learned it by contributing to open source. I learned it by being in IRC and talking to people and having people actually explain things to me when I didn't understand them. So to me, it's extremely important to have all this software that other people can use. And CNCF, like Cloud Native, sorry, in particular, is extremely important because that is what we want kind of like the world to move into. We want things to be accessible through the internet, which I believe should eventually become a human right. And just have people be able to just like scale and put everything that they need online and have easy access to all this technology that for a long time was extremely expensive and really hard to get your hands on. Today, that is, you can just click on it and you will have access to all this technology and be able to do what you need to do.
It's clear to you how you justify working in cloud native and how you tell the story to yourself that this is valuable work. And it's clear to me that that's a valid story. That's awesome. And it's really great to be able to do that stuff and to enable people to call their loved ones and research possibly at the same time. So yeah, you answered it just fine. It's really cool to know that you didn't go to college and that you learned everything together, because that really shores up this, you know, image I have of awesome developers being community-based first,
yeah,
right? Because you had to learn from other people. So, yeah.
Totally. And I'll tell you, even like, I wasn't into computers until I actually did that, because it was like, I was probably 18 years old. Like in my childhood, I only played outside in the mountains, in the rivers. Like I used to run with a machete in my hand, just like,
whoa, just
cutting grass. Man, I'm from South America. That's how we do it. So it is like that. And I say this because I'm actually happy that I had this childhood where I could just like interact with nature and eventually just find this thing that is going to be the tool and the stuff that I want to just like hack on and spend some more time on.
I'm really glad that you did bring up the college thing, because I don't know about where you were from, but for my parents, it was a very big issue between us, because I knew what I wanted to do. I had the same thing with you. Like, I saw the source code. I saw the future. So I thought, but it ended up turning out pretty good for me. I'm not going to lie. But I think maybe not so much now, but there's always been this kind of stigma, at least for me, especially like when you have a LinkedIn page and it says, what school did you go to? And then you put El Camino Real High School. It just looks kind of weird. But at the same time, I think this day and age, that stigma is kind of going away, because really the curriculum can't keep up with the technology, sort of in a way, because things are changing so quickly and more people are just learning on their own or learning through Stack Overflow and all these other channels that is not traditional education. So thank you for bringing that up, because to me, I was like, oh, he's definitely probably has his CS degree and all that other stuff, because I mean, you're a principal engineer at Red Hat, like one of the, that just got acquired for $38 billion. It's like a huge company that makes a huge impact in the world and the open source space. So yeah, I hope more people listening to this don't feel bad about not going to college or not being able to afford it or whatever the case might be, because you can succeed.
Yeah, you definitely should. Like, I think people should definitely not feel bad about not going to college. But I also think that if you're going to college, it's also absolutely fine. There's a very use, like, totally. There are things that you learn in college and there are things that you learn on the field. I think the only advantage that people that didn't go to college have, or the people that had that went to college, is that they get experience from the field right away, from day zero. Now, it comes with a cost. And there are many basic things. And by basic, I don't mean like obvious things, but like there's many theories that people that don't go to college don't know unless they actually need them. And this is how I've been like learning the things that I need. Like you face an issue, it sparks your curiosity, and you go and you read about it, you learn about it, and then you move on and you keep going. And then you go as deep as you have to go to actually be able to do the job that you have to do. Now, these are many things that people that actually go to college and go to like a regular curriculum, they will know from their studies, which is also like, it's all great information. I'm not saying that it's awesome information that maybe eventually when I retire, I'll just go and read all these books, because I still think it's very interesting. My fun anecdote about this is that I once tried to interview with Google they rejected me right off the bat because they asked me a very basic question that you would learn probably in the first semester of computer science, which is what is big O notation? And I was like, they were like, just write me this function that is like, I don't know, like O N and like log or whatever. And I was like, damn, I don't know. Like, I don't even know what this is. So I was like, can I Google it in the middle of the Google interview?
I've been rejected for more interviews for that question than any other. And I kind of refuse to learn because I'm just so sick of being asked. It's like, it's not relevant for what I'm
doing. Yeah, exactly. Right in the middle of the Google interview, I was like, can I Google this thing? And the guy was like, yeah, sure, go. I was like, and I did it. I was like, oh, okay. I understand the concept. I understand what it means, but you know, it's clear from our current interaction that I didn't know this basic thing that you believe is extremely important for my job. Now, if you ask me now, I'll tell you, like, I would never ask anyone that question on an interview. It has to be a very specific use case or like very specific technology that you need to be working on, like something that is extremely embedded. It has to be like absolutely fully optimized, whatever you want to put it, like in whatever way. But like now that like years and years and years after that, I have a different view of that interview. But like that very same day, I was like, had I gone to college, I would have known this thing, right? Like I would have been able to answer this question.
Totally. But could not disagree more. Speaking of someone who has gone to college for more years than is really necessary, college gives you absolutely none of this. In fact, the ability to decide to know what you're interested in, dive down and research it as deep as you want, and then move on to something else is something they don't teach you in college. In college, they teach you how to do really badly at everything all at the same time. Both of you actually benefited from not having gone. And this is like, I have two master's degrees. I know what I'm talking about. Don't get that. That whole having been said, you mentioned earlier about diving in. You mentioned it like in the very beginning of the podcast. I forget the exact quote, but I've been wondering for a second now. Since you have this great experience of like being interested in some stuff, which it meant that you maybe don't have the background that other people have, you haven't read Code 101, you know, Code Complete 2 may not be in your shelves, which is probably fine. It's a really big book. But I'm curious, why are you doing the exact thing you're doing now? How did you decide that this was interesting to you? How is it more interesting than running around with a machete in a river next to the mountains? Why cloud native?
All right. So first and foremost, I didn't say this was more interesting than running around with machete. I said, I used to do that. I wish I could go back to doing that, but I also have to eat. So
cool. Okay.
So making some money is part of the whole deal. Now, that being said, everyone is attracted to different challenges. I think the main thing under this whole thing that I really enjoy working in is distributed systems. So everything that has to do with multiple computers, multiple software having to interact with other parts of the architecture through the network and having to synchronize and having to solve these issues either through, you know, proper concurrency or parallelism or like just distributing the load or whatever. It's really the thing that attracts me the most. And there's a lot of that in the software that I'm working on right now. And having all these nodes, different hosts and terminal nodes like coming up and having all the different agents interacting with the service and making sure that the whole deployment process is working properly. So I've always been interested and attracted by distributed systems in general, because I guess it aligns a little bit with my obsession of communities and culture and having everyone actually agreeing with each other. I think it's like a big portion of that actually, you know, pushes me into trying to solve distributed issues and try to just like bring all the systems into agreement and to a state that we are all happy with. So how did I get here? That's a good question. I actually started working on a search engine back in a different company. It was actually based on Elasticsearch before Elastic, the company, existed. So it was very early days for Elasticsearch. We started working on that and trying to build NLP, a natural language processing algorithms on top of it. And it was part of like a more, like a bigger architecture. I was not so much into writing the algorithm itself. It was not something I was super interested in. I wanted to deal with, you know, what happens to the data from the moment it gets into our service, where it goes, where is it stored? How are we going to process it after? How is it going to end in the search engine? How is we're going to use the results from the search engine and how we're going to propose those to the user and how we're going to do this for, well, back in 2010, it was like terabytes and terabytes of data. So that was like massive amounts of data, at least for us at the moment. So I started working on that. That was a startup like normal, regular startup story, eventually ended up failing. And that's after that, I ended up moving to Red Hat when I started working on OpenStack, and it was like still attracted to the same issues. Like, it's a distributed computer provider and cloud provider. So how are we going to make all these different pieces work together? And this, in this case, it was very, they were all like very separate and different pieces. Like, one was providing virtualization, the other one is providing storage, the other one is providing images, the other one is providing like bare metal support and all those things. And it all has to work seamlessly. And within each of these services, there were like different parts that had to interact with each other. So it's always been around distributed systems in general. That's the part that really attracts me. I think the whole theory behind consensus and all these algorithms and how to make systems interact with each other in a way that they are fault tolerant is something that I find interesting, which also applies to Kubernetes in great detail, like in great extent, I mean.
So like fault tolerance is a huge field.
It is.
Right now, this week, what are you most interested in? What project is most interesting to you that you've like given into?
I don't think I've had to deal with a lot of fault tolerance in the last months, I guess.
It's, or concurrency or whatever. Like, do you
really yeah, concurrency is definitely... concurrency, I think, is definitely so. I think it's definitely a part of what we're doing in this assisted installer, because of the need of deploying all these nodes concurrently and making sure that all their state is properly managed and that all the agents have the information that they need to move on. And I guess the hard part comes when we need to make sure that all the network settings are set properly in all the nodes, and it doesn't end there. Like, when you're dealing as a list for with bare metal nodes as well, like, you also have to deal with the provisioning network, which is a separate network from the one that the actual cluster is going to end up in, which has its own challenges, especially because then you have to connect all these iDRACs that have their own problems that are probably not going to go too much into detail right now. But there's a different kind of distributed challenges that I'm dealing with right now that don't really have to do a lot with fault tolerance at this moment.
If you had to choose out of all your different projects, and I know you went back to Red Hat because the community is great, but if you had to choose a community you think is doing the best right now, or that really makes you feel good and warm inside, fuzzy, if you will, which would it be?
Well, I'm super excited with the community that we're building for Kubernetes, actually. It's still small, but it's
that's growing. The right answer.
Yeah. I mean it. It's still small, but it really excites me that from day zero, we're all being open to making the right calls that will favor community and that will favor contribution over just pushing features and just like adding stuff to the software. Like, it's being very focused on, we want to build a community. Like, the technology is there. The technology is there. The challenges are there. The ideas on where to get it next, they're all there. Now we need to make it happen. How can we make this happen in a way that we're not only going to make it happen, but also going to make it happen in a way that people will feel comfortable jumping into the project and jumping into Slack or the repo and contributing to the project? Because if we wanted to make it happen like utterly fast, then we're just like, not make it a community. Like, we'll just like code like crazy and just push everything. But even at the cost of moving slower, we're taking care of very important things like having proper CI. And I'm not mean CI in terms of we need to test our software. I mean CI in the sense of, if someone comes and submits a PR and the PR is not correct, what is the best way for us to communicate that to the person that is contributing that PR? Right? It's not so much about telling them your code is wrong, but it's or protecting that code to go into the repo, but it's about communicating properly to the rest of the community or the rest of the contributors, like, hey, this code is not working properly, and this is why, and have that a very expressive way to actually say this, because, like, I don't know, the test suite is extensive enough and it's super clear. So people, when they click on the link and they see the logs, it's obvious to them what's going on and how they can learn more. And the same thing applies for all the docs that are being built. How can we make this feature and document it in a way from day zero that is clear to people what it is meant to do and where we're after? Again, like, the community is not too big, but again, at the cost of moving slower, many things are being done for the community and for the thing that we want to build and that we want to be like this security project or like all the proxies out there, basically. So that is, seriously, I'm extremely excited about this. And this is something that I It's close to my heart. Again, communities and cultures are really close to my heart, way more than software is. And to me, this is extremely valuable. It's something that you would think that you would find pretty much everywhere nowadays, considering how much this is being talked about in social media, like Twitter. If you go to Twitter, everyone is saying like community and like, you got to be nice and we're done with all the jerks and we're done with all that. And like, and then eventually like, you go to some repo and that is just full of those people. Also, maybe because I don't want to rant a lot about it, but I'll see the glass half full and say that there are good cases like the queer fans community that are taking all the right steps where community and people come first. And despite, once again, at the cost of moving slower.
Just to add on that real quick, it really comes from the top, because here's one thing that really impressed me with Flavio is when the whole GitHub thing came out when they're changing from master to main, the fact that he brought it up first, like I was like kind of hesitant because I was like, oh, I don't know if this is my place to do it. But he said from the get-go, we need to switch to main because we want more contributions and we want to be more inclusive to the community. I'm like, Siri, where did you find this angel? He gets it. Like he gets it.
I just opened a drive-by just issue on assisted installer asking for a contributing guide. So I'm really excited about that. Thank you so much, Flavio. I think we're coming at the end of our time here, however, because podcasts are mortal things that
I am starving. I'm starving.
Also, food is very good. Flavio, thank you so much. This was awesome. Where can people find you online? Where can they read more about the things you do? Where can they find your tweets?
Yeah, funnily enough, as much as I complain about Twitter, I'm still on Twitter. So that would be Flapper87, FLAPER87. And yes, 87 is the year that I was born in. So just in case you're asking.
Goodness.
Yeah.
My sister was born in 87.
Yeah, there you go. Best year ever. And yeah, so that would be it. Then all my links are there. I don't tweet as much. I used to tweet way more than I do right these days, but I'm still there. I still enjoy reading some of the tweets and blocking the ones that I don't like.
Well, Zuri, I think we should get him a mic and then he can be on this podcast as a panelist more often.
Yeah. I love being on podcasts, honestly.
I agree.
Cool. Thank you so much, Flapper87, everyone. Looking forward to our next podcast. Flavio, looking forward to seeing you around. And I'm still enviously living in Lake Como. All right. Catch you later.
Yeah. Bye.
Thanks. Thank you, Flavio. Bye-bye.